everyone, and welcome to our Tuesday evening lecture. My name is Rebecca Hall. I'm a member of the Executive Council for AIIA Queensland, and I'm hosting tonight's program in absence of Geoffrey Ewing, our President. I'm really pleased to be hosting tonight's program because we have an absolutely fantastic speaker, Rowan Callick, who's joining us tonight to speak on the topic of the international dimensions of the debate about refugees. Well, he's going to be talking to us about who's travelling where and why, about the refugee situations and the broader political and economic settings, including in the Asia Pacific, and some of the solutions that the Australian government is looking at. Many of you will know Rowan. You would read him regularly in The Australian, and we're absolutely honoured to have you here tonight to share with us. We're a very active group here in Queensland, so I'm sure there's going to be a number of questions and certainly an interesting debate around that. So without further ado, Rowan Callick.
Thanks very much for inviting me, and I'm going to talk about just that, the international dimensions. People have been on the move for a very long time. The Hakka people, of course, dispersed from northern China all over Southeast Asia. The Hazaras, who have become amongst the most prominent people seeking asylum in Australia, were probably people who were derived from Mongolia, who came with Genghis Khan. Actually, if you meet Hazaras, you can see that in them, and were stranded in what is now Afghanistan. Austronesians, the people of the Pacific, mostly emerged from Taiwan. And the DNA of Taiwanese Aborigines has a huge connection with that of Austronesian people, Micronesian people, and some Melanesians, and certainly Polynesians. And then, of course, from Samoa, canoes set off about 800 years ago to the north. Some arrived in Hawaii, and some arrived in New Zealand, and they became the people we call Maori. So people have been driven by a desire for a better life. They've been driven by starvation. They've been driven by war, disease. Always seeking stability, a firm sense of self, a clear identity, and they've normally been push and pull factors, as people call them. So the push factors are the negative situation where they are, and the pull factor is the hope or dream of a better life in some other place. My own family, interestingly, perhaps, certainly interestingly to people in non-migrant countries, so there's myself, wife and two children, each born in a different country and all now living in Australia. The global situation is a lot of change. There's always change here. In 2001, there were 620,000 asylum seekers. In 2010, 358,000, down 42%. The biggest number of asylum seekers in 2010, which country do you think they were from? There we are. This is United Nations High Commission for Refugees Statistics. This is what I'm taking. What do you think was the biggest source of asylum seekers in 2010? Anyone want to guess? No. Serbia. So the biggest number were Serbians, then Afghans, then Chinese. And we saw, some people might have seen a program made by the BBC that Four Corners screened on Monday night, which showed North Africans going to small island off Italy, of Lampedusa. 6,000 people live on the island. 40,000 people have come there from North Africa over the last year. So we see all sorts of sudden changes. The United States is the largest recipient of asylum seekers, and the United States, the biggest number is Chinese going there, and then, as you'd expect, Mexicans. A person becomes... So some definitions, I think. So the United Nations High Commission for Refugees was established in 1951. Before that, this was a refugee was a term without clear definition. And in 1951, there were about 1.5 million refugees internationally, many of those displaced in Europe by the Second World War still. By 1980, the number was estimated at 8.2 million. Refugees are individuals recognised under that convention that set up UNHCR relating to the status of refugees. Asylum seekers are defined as individuals who sought international protection and whose claims for refugee status have not yet been determined. And then we have internally displaced persons, a very large number of them. A person becomes legally a refugee from the moment he or she fulfills the criteria set out in that 1951 convention. The formal recognition of someone as such does not establish refugee status, the UN says, but confirms it. And the country of asylum is normally responsible for determining whether an asylum seeker is a refugee or not. That's in the case of signatories to the convention. Malaysia is not a signatory, and so the UNHCR itself does that act of determining. At the end of 2009, there were 43 million forcibly displaced people worldwide in those three categories. 15.2 million refugees, over 800,000 asylum seekers, and 27 million internally displaced people. So that's the biggest number of that total. So 43 million people forcibly displaced. Asia provides almost half the global applicants for asylum. Africa 30%, Europe 13%, and the Americas 11%. United States, the biggest recipient, has changed little in the 126 years since Emma Lazarus wrote her poem, The New Colossus, which is engraved on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. Some of us have seen that. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest tossed to me, I lift my lamp beside the golden door. The industrialized countries receiving the most refugees recently have been in similar order to the targets of the asylum applicants. US number one, Canada, France, Italy, Britain, Sweden, Germany, Greece, Switzerland and Norway. So these vast flows of people across borders follow decades during which trade and investment barriers have been steadily eroded, allowing capital to shift in nanoseconds across the world, and the internet, of course, has broken through communication boundaries. It's inevitable that people would also wish to be on the move, for myriad reasons. It's helped that air travel, the way many asylum seekers arrive at their chosen destinations, has become widely affordable. Four-fifths of the world's 15 plus million refugees are hosted by developing countries, and three quarters of them reside in countries that border on their country of origin. Pakistan, Iran, and Syria consequently host the largest refugee populations, with 1.9 million, 1.1 million, and 1 million respectively. The UNHCR representative for Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific says, in global terms, the number of refugees and asylum seekers in Australia, which they number at 26,000, is very small. The regional situation. The countries of almost every country in East Asia and the major countries of the Pacific have got together in the regional ministerial conference on people smuggling, which has had a number of meetings, which was first held in Bali in Indonesia and continues to be, the meetings continue to be held there. Our foreign minister attended the most recent conference, which took place in March this year. And they call these conferences on people smuggling, trafficking in persons, and related transnational crime. This is a response to not only the understandable and legitimate numbers of refugees moving across borders and within, but concern about the implications for these states. The ministers, I'm reading from the official statement from the last Bali meeting, ministers noted the large number of irregular migrants moving through the region and expressed concern about the risks to the lives and human rights of those being smuggled and trafficked. Ministers noted with concern the large number of lives lost due to the actions of smugglers and traffickers. They acknowledged that the root causes of movements within the region were numerous, involving economic, social, and political aspects. They acknowledged that poverty, economic disparities, labour market opportunities, conflict, insecurity were major causes contributing to the continuing prevalence of people smuggling and human trafficking, both globally and regionally. In addition, they noted that differences in treatment and access to permanent outcomes for asylum seekers contributed to onwards movement, the latter meaning the pull part of the push and pull factor. And they agreed at that meeting in March to a regional cooperation framework. The core principles were five. One, irregular movement facilitated by people smuggling syndicates should be eliminated, and states should promote and support opportunities for orderly migration. Number two, where appropriate and possible, asylum seekers should have access to consistent assessment processes, whether through a set of harmonised arrangements or through the possible establishment of regional assessment arrangements, which might include a centre or centres taking into account any existing sub-regional arrangement. And it's that clause on which our Prime Minister has been hanging the claim that our so-called regional solution is a regional solution. Number three, persons found to be refugees under those assessment processes should be provided with a durable solution, including voluntary repatriation, resettlement within and outside the region, and where appropriate, possible in-country solutions. Number four, persons found not to be in need of protection should be returned, preferably on a voluntary basis, to their countries of origin in safety and dignity. Returns should be sustainable and states should look to maximise opportunities for greater cooperation. And fifth, people smuggling enterprises should be targeted through border security arrangements, law enforcement activities and disincentives for human trafficking and smuggling. I'll move on now to the situation here in Australia. Of the 8,250 asylum seekers last year, 47% were boat arrivals, the others came by air. The biggest number were from Afghanistan. And we were 21st of 44 industrialised countries in terms of the number of asylum seekers per 1,000 people in our population. So we're about halfway through in terms of us being a pull factor. The UNHCR's own description of Australia's role says this: in Australia, a strong resettlement program continues to provide durable solutions for refugees from the region and around the world. While asylum seekers, in particular the arrival of asylum seekers by boat, are likely to continue to generate public debate, in 2011, UNHCR will continue to work with the Australian government and other concerned actors to pursue effective regional solutions to the mixed migration phenomena and to search for improved protection conditions in the sub-region. The term boat people entered our vernacular in the 1970s when there was the first wave of boats carrying people seeking asylum in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. Over half the Vietnamese population was displaced in these years. And they went in all sorts of directions, some on by boat heading here. And the first boat arrived in Darwin in April 1976 with five people on board. And over the following 9 years, that was the first wave. There were 2,059 arrivals in the first 5 years. And then there was a second wave starting in 1989 from Vietnam again, also from Cambodia and southern China. And in 1999, we've seen a third wave, predominantly from the Middle East, and often in larger numbers and usually with the assistance of some sort of syndicates. In terms of refugee resettlement, only about 20 nations worldwide currently participate in UNHCR resettlement programs and accept quotas of refugees on an annual basis. Australia is one of the countries formally participating. Each year, the government allocates around 13,000 available places through the Department of Immigration's humanitarian program. Last year, Australia accepted the third largest number of refugees for resettlement after the USA and Canada. We assessed, in terms of those 8,250 asylum seekers, so that when I talk about the number of refugees who came here, so some came from various processes. We assessed, according to the UNHCR statistics last year, 8,250 claims. And of these claims, the first number, I said, were Afghans. Second, 1,200 were Chinese. And then about half that number, the next biggest number was Sri Lankans, then Fiji, then Iran, Pakistan, Zimbabwe, India, Iraq, and Egypt. That's the order. And then we've got Zimbabwe and Iran. And they also have the figures from the embassies. People who managed to apply formally through embassies, 5 out of 18 were accepted from Ho Chi Minh. It's not really an embassy, it's a consulate from Saigon. 1,340 from 1,757 in Bangkok. 340 from 1,059 in KL, Kuala Lumpur. 138 out of 426 in Jakarta. 60 from 174 in Beijing, and 14 out of 53 in Suva. We had an occasion when, I'm trying to think what year it was, someone here will probably know because I was actually not living in the country, but we had 43 Melanesians from the Indonesian province of Papua arrived here by traditional...
2006.
Canoes, 2006 was it, right. And they were granted refugee status, prompting something of a short-lived, I have to say, diplomatic crisis with Jakarta. But they were not followed by fleets of outriggers. And surprisingly, few Papua New Guineans who live an even shorter canoe ride away have drifted south seeking material opportunities, largely denied them by their home country's economy. It's very interesting. Those of you who read Sherlock Holmes will think this is the dog that did not bark in the night, that we're not seeing Melanesians coming here. Australia's geographic situation is unusual within the industrialised group. The lists of countries that I've read out that have received... that tend to receive asylum seekers, as we have no shared land border. That marks us out from the US, with which we share similarities as a multicultural nation heavily dependent on migration. American attitudes to illegal immigration are typically ambiguous, in part because of the heavy dependence of sections of the US economy on illegal migrant labour. Areas that I would suggest we might expect to see increasing numbers of asylum seekers in the future, in the next year or two, will be Afghanistan, continuing conflict there, Pakistan, as what I might call Talibanization spreads in Pakistan, arousing anxiety amongst the country's substantial middle class. It's also the country that houses the largest number of refugees in relation to its own economic capacity, most of them from Afghanistan. Somalia, which continues to provide a model for the concept of the failed state. Fiji also, I think, will continue to be a source of people who will claim asylum here. The ruler of Fiji talks about an election in or from September 2014, but that's a long way away. And Zimbabwe, perhaps, also may be a continuing source of refugees, with President Robert Mugabe... probably going through to another election after this one, reluctant to relinquish ultimate control. Attitudes in Australia. The Australian Survey of Social Attitudes, Murray Goot, professor at Macquarie University, said to me last time I talked to him, he said that actually, interestingly, and perhaps contrary to the expectations of some people in this room, during the period of the Howard government, opposition to immigration fell. Views about multiculturalism remain mixed, and our beliefs about how migrants affect the economy, jobs and crime became more positive. In 1996, the survey said that about two-thirds of Australians wanted fewer immigrants, but the last survey showed that the proportion had fallen to less than a third, including the biggest support for the immigration program since the old the end of the Second War. Gute says that falling unemployment and growing prosperity is probably also a major factor. And central to this evolution of attitudes, or the indication of it really, was of course the rise and fall of Pauline Hanson. Her rise alarmed Asia, but it also confronted Australian voters with a clear-cut choice about issues relating to immigration and economic opening. Her failure to win seats to Parliament, consecutive elections, have changed that debate a bit. But of course, we do have a debate about a big Australia or a bigger Australia, and that debate sees people become strange bedfellows because we see the Greens as the biggest opponents of a planned migration program through that. Since 1945, Australia as a whole has accepted more than 700,000 refugees. And generally, as I described us as a country with a planned immigration policy, it may surprise some people that we're rather unusual in that regard. Countries like Britain do not have a planned migration policy at all. They don't, I think, even have a minister for immigration. So people who choose to come in a very haphazard way, we have this program that's been in place since Federation. And of course, the most famous thing about those early days was the Calabar, the anxiety expressed in those years about the yellow peril. So we introduced the famous dictation test. People here probably know something about that test, in which people wanting to migrate here had to answer questions in any European language that could be chosen. And so that effectively kept out people, mainly the people who are coming were Asian, and a lot of hardship and terrible situations happened between, particularly within Chinese families. And then after World War II, of course, we needed the labour, we've taken advantage of that, and we have a planned process. I might refer to my own recent experience of being in the Ted Witten Football Oval in Footscray in Melbourne, when the people South Sudanese origins were voting in a referendum about whether they wanted to become a separate country, and this was one of the most uplifting and vibrant occasions I've attended in Australia, I would have to say. It was not a quiet scene. And, of course, some of you may have seen on television at the weekend scenes of celebration about obviously the referendum overwhelmingly wanted a separate nation. It's now been established. I'll move on. I won't talk about this. There's a lot one could say about mandatory detention and so on, which is really a domestic situation. I'll move on quickly through to some attitudes of people here in the latest Lowy Institute poll, 2011. Lowy's done this now for 5 or 6 years. They've asked about asylum seekers here. I'll just quickly go through what they've discovered in terms of Australian response. there's been a slight drop in the proportion of Australians concerned about unauthorised asylum seekers coming to Australia by boat. It's 72% are concerned, down 6 points since last year. But the majority, 51%, are in the very concerned bracket. The older you are, the more concerned you are. To try to better understand the reasons, we presented the 72% who said they were concerned with seven different arguments made about unauthorised asylum seekers, and asking them if they agreed or disagreed with its different propositions. And so the biggest number who agreed were 92% said their concern was that they might be badly injured or killed during the boat trip. 88% were concerned about them jumping the queue. I should point out, by the way, that this idea of a queue is, of course, something devised by governments, because the government imposes its own numbers. And then 85% a potential security risk to Australia, and too much money is spent processing unauthorised asylum seekers, 85%. Now, I'm going to finish by talking about the Malaysia and the recent moves to resolve those concerns of that 72% by sending people for processing to Papua New Guinea, Malaysia. And Papua New Guinea is a signatory to the convention. So Papua New Guinea is actually itself responsible for assessing whether people are refugees or not. Papua New Guinea has had for a long time about 10,000 refugees from Papua, from Indonesia, and finds that a bit of a drain and a problem. So the idea of they had all these people, some people on Manus Island under the Howard government's Pacific Solution, and now there's a desire to reopen the Manus Centre. A friend of mine, Poris Parkop, who's the governor of Port Moresby, says the PNG constitution doesn't allow people to be kept without being charged behind bars. So the people will have, if they go to Manus, they will have to be allowed to go where they like. So this raises some very interesting questions for both sides. The Malaysian solution is mostly about Burmese. 93,000 asylum seekers and proven refugees in Malaysia. Most of them live in this Klang Valley around Kuala Lumpur. I was recently in Kuala Lumpur. I went to the UNHCR headquarters and talked to people there, different groups, and they mainly come from those, what they call ethnic groups, who have been in conflict with the regime in the army in Burma, and they've come down sometimes by land, sometimes by water through Thailand, and have arrived. Malaysia gives them no legal status. They're in a very uncertain position, and they tend to be looked after by UNHCR and by NGOs. And you see lots of people coming there to the compound, UNHCR compound, looking to be declared, at least formally declared, asylum seekers, and the UN will give them an ID card which will try to protect them from being locked up in detention camps in Malaysia, which are for illegal migrants, because Malaysia has 2 million workers who are legally there, mainly from Indonesia and some from Philippines and surrounding countries, and it has an estimated 600,000 illegal migrant workers. So these people from Burma are getting confused with these illegal migrant workers who are unpopular. It's a very messy situation. in there. Solomon Islands offered to host a refugee processing centre on our behalf at a disused Air Force base on Stirling Island in the Western Province, because they said having the base there would enable them to impose more controls on the to and fro with Papua New Guinea's island of Bougainville, which continues to be a source of armaments and other the flow of people that they don't really want in the Solomon Islands. So that's the reason that Solomon Islands wanted to be involved. They're a signatory, that they're a member of the Bali process, but our government said no to them. Now, I'll close here by talking about what I see as the big negative about this whole process. You know, that our neighbourhood was talked about as an arc of instability at one phrase. It's a pet phrase being used a few years ago. And we seem to see disaster looming like distant thunder wherever we looked in these islands, Timor, Solomons, Papua New Guinea, and so on. My view now is that it's Australia which is the distant thunder causing trouble for these countries and trying to bring our own problems, asking them to help solve our problems. And I think this is quite an issue. The neighbours are worrying about us. They know the backdrop. They know Australia. They know the domestic political situation. And we have gone to Timor, we've gone to Papua New Guinea, we've gone to Malaysia without resolve, without any firm plans in place. It's being caught up in the political processes there, the political processes here. People there are very familiar with what the situation is. And so, in my view, this has caused us to have problems with our neighbours, which need resolving. That in turn has highlighted the extent of the gap between our foreign minister, who comes from this city, and the government in which he serves, as he leads the charge on myriad global fronts while steering clear of helping to resolve issues. John Donne, 500 years ago, said, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me because I'm involved in mankind. Therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." No man is an island, and Australia might appear to be so, but it's not. There you go.